In Belén, a protester is lying face down in the dirt. His shirt is pulled up around his neck, revealing his naked back, upon which an Israeli soldier sits. The soldier's hand rests on the protester's jeans, the gun on his back. In the background, razor wire. This photograph is from John Elmer's photo essay, Belén, A Struggle in Pictures. John is a Canadian photographer and journalist who has recently returned from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. He's also the co-creator of the online journal from OccupiedPalestine.org. John joins me now in the studio. Hi, John.
Thanks for having me.
You were in Belén to witness the protests against the Israeli wall. Can you describe the resistance that you saw there?
Sure. Well, Belén is a really good example of a popular struggle against Israel's barrier, separation wall, apartheid wall, depending on which side of the conflict you're viewing the wall from. It's a popular movement in that identifying that the wall was coming through their village, a village of about 1,000 acres just outside of the Palestinian city of Ramallah. The wall is going to annex fully 60% of Belén's territory. So everybody in the village is affected by this development, and everybody in the village of Belén, by and large, has mobilized in opposition to the wall. So really what you have is a popular movement. You know, the demonstrations, the weekly demonstrations, involve children as young as 5 and 6 and elders in the community as old as their 70s. It bases around the community. The demonstrations begin every week at the mosque, at the rallying point, and march down to the wall. So what we're really seeing is week in and week out in a place like Belén, a popular nonviolent struggle against the wall that's being by and large ignored here in North American media coverage of the events in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
And is it? Do you think it's ignored because it is a nonviolent popular movement?
I think that the wall, the story of the wall, hasn't been played nearly as highly in the media as it should have been, and as it should be. What's essentially happening in Palestine right now is that the Israeli occupation forces are building literal ghettos for the Palestinians to live in. The wall is 700 kilometers long, but it's not a border. It's not a political border in the sense that it runs between territories. It runs actually through Palestinian territory, weaving in and out of villages, weaving around and around, creating what Israeli planners call cantons, but what the Afrikaners in South Africa called Bantustans, or what we in Canada call reserves or reservations, and what the Nazis in occupied Europe called ghettos. Essentially, they're enclosed areas where nobody has the ability to move in and out of those areas. So it's a very significant development, and one that has been covered, a little bit in North America, but generally in the terms of security. And that's always the way this conflict is framed, in terms of security.
With the protests and the resistance that you saw, what sort of reaction did you see from the Israeli security forces?
Well, their tactics have changed somewhat in the village of Belén compared to places that we're more familiar with, such as Jenin or Nablus, the Balata refugee camp, or even in Gaza. In Belén, because the struggle is partly organized by Israelis and as well attended by internationals, there's a certain political space that's provided for the people of Belén, a certain amount of media coverage that allows a little bit of a buffer for the Israeli tactics. That being said, live fire is common. Tear gas, concussion grenades are weekly events. Armored Israeli jeeps invading the village, common tactics being used. Arrests every week, arrests of Palestinians and Israelis, targeting of the organizers, a very standard tactics of policing these demonstrations going on in Belén.
And so in other towns and villages that you visited, was there the same type of resistance?
Belén has become emblematic, has become symbolic, and therefore has become a little bit more high profile and is able to have a staying capacity that other villages haven't been able to maintain. I think it's important to note to listeners that the speed at which the wall, the barrier, is being created is very quick. It's happening very quickly on the ground, and many of these villages don't have time to mobilize in any kind of meaningful way, because by the time they do, the wall's finished, it's an existent reality, the ghetto shadow is complete. In Bilayin, for a number of reasons, political and otherwise, the wall has taken a fair amount of time to be completed. It's now more than a year they've been working on the wall in the area around Bilayin, in the Ramallah area. And so it's provided certain political space for people to continue their demonstrations in a way that other villages haven't been allowed.
The International Court of Justice ruled that the West Bank Wall is illegal under international law, and the Israeli government has rejected that ruling. And here we often see the wall as being that sort of international legal or political issue, but you've seen the physical structure and the real effects on people and their communities. Can you talk a bit about what the wall is doing in places like Bilayin or in other places?
Sure. Well, like I said, in Bilayin, which is a pretty quintessential Palestinian West Bank village, an agrarian village, they're being fully severed from their land, from their olive trees, hundreds and hundreds of olive trees that have been in their families for generations, that have been farmed for generations, now become de facto part of Israel. There's going to be a number of gates in the wall to apparently allow Palestinians access to their land. But so far, the wall is complete at about 60% of the West Bank, and these gates haven't been forthcoming with Palestinian use of their land. So effectively, you have the theft of land again of Palestinians. And the impact that this has is on a fundamental level, particularly when you're talking about agrarian villages. When you're talking about urban centers where you have the actual physical concrete wall, 8 meters high, wire on the top, sniper towers, this wall is dividing Palestinians in urban areas from other urban areas. And that impact has been fundamental in terms of work, in terms of accessing services, in terms of visiting family, in terms of simply going to school and carrying on your daily life. The wall runs right down the middle of some streets, dividing village from village. And it's important to understand to listeners that, as I said, it's not a border between Israel and some entity called Palestine. It's a border between Palestinian areas and other Palestinian areas. Palestinians are being separated from each other and being enclosed into ghettos. And the term isn't a platitude. It's an existent reality for people. There's a pass system whereby if you don't have the right color pass, you can't enter one area or another in the West Bank. People that live in Gaza can't visit Jerusalem. People who have grown up in Gaza and are my age have never prayed at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, the third holiest site in Islam. This is the kind of separation that these ghettos create. It's an existent reality, an existent separation between peoples. And the impact of this is really crucial. It's hard to explain in words. People's lives are being fundamentally altered.
You talked a bit about what the wall looks like in terms of the height and the concrete barrier. What about the area, sort of the land that it covers, the width of the wall?
Well, it's an important question because there's a lot of discussion about whether it's a wall or whether it's a fence. And the idea of that it's a fence is a little bit more subtle and innocuous. It's not so problematic as a wall, which sounds daunting. The reality is the fence is actually worse than the wall. The fence is a massive apparatus that spans about 100 meters in many places. It includes razor wire trenches, 3 electronic roads, trace roads for the army to circle around and around. And when this is in rural areas, you're talking about it taking people's farmland. And so actually the fence, which sounds a little bit nicer than a wall, is actually worse. Whereas the wall is in urban centers, it's only about 5 feet thick. I say only 5 feet thick concrete, 8 meters high with sniper towers around it, massive gates that people come in and go through that are monitored by the army. Both structures are very significant, and the term ghetto is a very prescient term when you've seen it on the ground.
You've been speaking across the country recently about your experience in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and one thing you have been talking about is what the Israelis call the disengagement from the Gaza Strip. What stories of this do you want to bring here?
Well, first and foremost, the term disengagement is a political fiction. It has no resonance historically, and it's a term that Israel created because what it was doing from Gaza was not technically, legally a withdrawal. It wasn't a withdrawal. It was a civilian redeployment. They moved their civilian settlements out of the area, and they redeployed their military to the borders. Israel still controls the airspace, it controls the sea, it controls the land crossings, and it's got artillery batteries encircling the Gaza Strip. Nobody can leave the Gaza Strip, nobody can enter the Gaza Strip. There's no way to access the West Bank from the Gaza Strip. So what was played off in the media as a step towards peace was actually an entrenching of the occupation regime. And in fact, in one story that I wrote, I gleaned statistics from the Israeli Interior Ministry, which indicated that 18,000 Jewish settlers moved into illegal settlements in the West Bank during the disengagement process when 6,000 settlers left Gaza. So what was played off in the international media as a step towards peace was actually a net increase of 12,000 settlers living in illegally occupied territory. The main reason that Israel has executed this disengagement is because of what they call the demographic bomb, the idea that the Palestinian Arab population will outpace the Jewish Israeli population in the areas under Israel's control, which includes the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. The move is a demographic move in order to preserve the Jewish state, to preserve a Jewish majority in that area. And in doing so, when you release 6,000 settlers from Gaza, where they live amongst 1.5 million Palestinians, you free up some of that demographic. It's a very crude analysis. It's a very crude way to break down real people's lives in terms of demography. But it's very much a prominent aspect within the Israeli occupation regime.
Since the election of Hamas, the focus in a lot of Western countries, and including the Canadian government, is on cutting aid to the Palestinians. What do you think of this?
Well, so again, in North America, we use all these euphemisms, cutting aid to Hamas, starving Hamas. Well, what does this mean? Hamas is the Palestinian people, like it or not. They won an overwhelming electoral victory in elections that were free and fair, admitting the fact that they took place under occupation with a Palestinian refugee community of 5 million unable to vote. When you talk about cutting off aid to Hamas and starving Hamas, you're talking about starving the Palestinian people. People have to understand that Palestinians don't have the welfare apparatus that we have here in North America. They don't have credit cards and savings accounts. They don't have employment insurance and welfare. And they don't have savings accounts in any meaningful way. Less than 10% of the Palestinian population has savings accounts. So when you talk about cutting off financial aid, which is generally manifests itself in food aid, you're talking about people on the edge of survival being cut off from their only link. It's incredible terminology. It's incredible that these euphemisms can go over without any comment when the reality is we're talking about real people's lives. We're not talking about abstractions or debates had in newspaper op-ed pages. We're talking about real people's lives. And for the Palestinians, the cutting off of aid to the Palestinian Authority would be a catastrophe, and it would happen very, very quickly. The chaos that would ensue is real because people don't have anything to fall back on.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
I have been speaking with journalist and photographer John Elmer. John is the co-creator of the online journal from OccupiedPalestine.org. This is Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.